I think that's probably one of the biggest areas leadership from the military, a lesson that you can bring to the business world or the non-military side, however you want to call it, is that idea of not just a manager, but a leader, which really comes down to caring for your people. And you're going back to trust, talking about that. You know, when people know you truly care for them, not just lip service, but you're truly putting, whether it's putting your neck on the line for someone, you know, jumping in the trenches with them, whatever it is, when people see that, you know, kind of that leading in the front, for lack of a better term, that's where that trust comes from. And when leaders have their own accountability, own their own mistakes, that's when your people are going to exhibit accountability as well.
Welcome to CEO on the Go, the show about personal and professional growth for busy leaders like you. I'm Gail Lance, and I'm here to help you think differently, solve big problems, and inspire change. It's tough to do on your own and even with a team, but it is possible. So let's get started. Welcome back to another episode. Today, I'm excited to share with you a fighter pilot's perspective on leading in complexity, uncertainty, and change. And I'm guessing you might feel like a fighter pilot yourself at times, especially when you're laser focused on your own mission. Inevitably, you'll experience turbulence in situations at work, whether with your team or with the organization as a whole. I had a great conversation with Brandon Williams. Brandon is a U.S. Air Force F-15E fighter pilot. He's also a leadership speaker and coach, and he helps leaders transform their teams into high-performing, high-reliability organizations by harnessing the same tools used by U.S. Air Force fighter pilots. Brandon's got decades of experience as an Air Force fighter pilot and lieutenant colonel navigating complex situations, so he understands the critical human factors for mitigating errors, managing change, and maximizing team execution. As always, we covered a lot of issues with emphasis on building accountability and trust, and of course, how to prepare for and deal with turbulence. I especially like Brandon's take on creating a debrief culture, which he'll explain, and the specific practice of you going first as a leader to own what you could have done differently to set up your team members for success. So if, or rather when, you feel like you're trying to navigate through uncertainty, apply the ideas that Brandon offers to help you fly high with power to achieve your goals. Enjoy my conversation with Brandon Williams. Brandon, great to have you here on the podcast. And first, thank you for your service.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Gail. And thank you for having me on. Looking forward to it.
I know that you and I were talking and the theme of turbulence just seems to be a natural theme that we need to talk about. I'm working hard to help my clients kind of move through that, understand that change is constant, dealing with lots of uncertainty and complexity. So I'm really eager to get your perspective on that and what you've learned through your experience and your training that can help other leaders who want to move through, you know, some challenging times in a smoother way. So we've touched on accountability and building trust. What do you think is a good starting point then when you're thinking about helping leaders move through trust? What's one of the first things that they need to really be focusing on?
Yeah, well, again, Gail, thank you so much for having me. And that's such a great topic. You know, when you talk about trust, it's such a big thing now, right? You know, people are talking about in business, you know, as leaders, that transparency and how do I gain that trust in my people and how do we show that? And so I, you know, something I go back to, you kind of said accountability. So I'll tie it to that because, I mean, there's several different area things you could talk about when you talk about trust. But I, as a leader, I think the number one thing is that piece of accountability. So I'll kind of set this up. You know, when you talk about leading in turbulent times or change or complexity and just trying to do everything, well, you know, Harvard Business Review had a great study years ago, and they studied, you know, mediocre teams, high performing teams, and what was it that made these high performing teams. And one of the things they found out is that in, let's say, poor performing teams, there was no accountability, right? At any level, really. In mediocre teams, the, you know, bosses, supervisors, manage, you know, you name it, they ran accountability. But in high performing teams, it was peers that owned accountability. So peer level accountability of getting the job done, supporting each other. Something I talk about in my methodology of what I call mutual support. It's that peer accountability. But why I bring that up though is, as a leader, if you want to instill that in your organization and drive that trust in your organization, you as a leader have to show accountability first. Okay, you as a leader have to be able to step up. And when we've had a misstep, when I've made a wrong decision, or when I don't know all the answers, right? And that's one of the biggest things I think leaders struggle with, is it is okay to not have all the answers as the number one person, right? It's okay to not know. I mean, working with business leaders, I see this all the time, and they'll ask me like, "Brent, I don't know what to do here, and I, you know, this or this." And I'll say, "Well, you know, what does your team say? What is this person?" They're like, "Well, yeah, I know, but I should know." I'm like, "Okay, yeah, maybe you should, but at the same time, nobody's expecting you to know everything, to know all the answers all the time." And I explain to them, "Look, think about when you work for someone, when someone came to you to ask you, you know, especially someone at, you know, in hierarchical above you in an org chart or whatever, came to you and asked you, 'Hey, what do you think about this? Or what's your inputs on this? Or how do you think I can do this?' Think about how that made you feel, how that person trusted you, and how that person was coming to you for advice." And so I said, it makes you a better leader when you can admit when you don't have all the answers all the time. And that's okay.
So is that one of the measures then, is being able to admit, you know, because accountability, I think, can mean different things to different people. So I'd be curious to know more about how you measure that. What do you look for specifically?
Oh, I think accountability, it gets a negative connotation a lot of times. And you say that, and when you say the word, I always joke that when I hear the word accountability, I think of my elementary school vice principal, the kind of the enforcer of the, you know, enforcement arm of the school or whatever. It's kind of that do this or else mentality when people hear accountability. That's why I talk a lot about peer accountability, or mutual support, as we called it in the world I came from, of a flying high performance aircraft in very dynamic environments. And it's really that idea that no longer are you just concerned about your own well-being or your own success as a person or as a professional, but more importantly, you're concerned about the well-being of the team. And that's more important than your own spotlight. Something that's very, very hard to achieve in an organization, especially if you don't have that culture, right?
Yes. And people need to know that that is the intent of the leader, is to really be there for the team versus making themselves look good.
Yeah. And the only way a leader does that is by showing that themselves, right? Is by not always taking, "Hey, when something goes right, it's always on me." Or when something goes wrong, pointing the finger at others, that kind of that blame and train approach, right? You've got to go the opposite way of that. You know, going back to the military and coming from a flying squadron, you know, or very high reliability organization, one thing you always noted was that our commanders, our leadership roles, you were essentially graded on not the way you did things, but you were graded on the way essentially your people accomplished things. You know, what were the accomplishments of the people that were under your command? And that's a lot of times how you got graded, how you got, you know, moved on to different areas and things like that. So it was very much an idea of, how are you running your organization? How are you setting up your team so that everyone in your team succeeds? That was just a huge part. Not only were as a pilot, were you just a pilot, but you're also a leader and an officer responsible for the caring feeding of your people. And that was so huge. And that's the biggest, I think that's probably one of the biggest areas leadership from the military, a lesson that you can bring to the business world or the non-military side, however you want to call it, is that idea of not just a manager, but a leader, which really comes down to caring for your people. And you're going back to trust, talking about that. When people know you truly care for them, not just lip service, but you're truly putting, whether it's putting your neck on the line for someone, jumping in the trenches with them, whatever it is, when people see that leading in the front, for lack of a better term, that's where that trust comes from. And that, and when leaders, going back to accountability, have their own accountability, own their own mistakes, that's when your people are going to exhibit accountability as well.
Yeah, I love how you link the connection between accountability and how that fosters trust. So I'm curious to know, have you been in situations or seen when trust is broken, and how you might repair that if it's possible? I work with a lot of leaders, you know, given the pace of change, which is so fast, a lot of things are shifting. It's been affecting relationships. Even with people who've worked together for many years, I see there's all of a sudden this, wait a minute, something's different here. It seems like trust is threatened. So what's been your experience, and what advice would you have when that seems to be broken?
I think the first thing, Gail, is when you talk about that, you know, whether it's trust has been broken or however you're labeling that, whether it's with a peer or a manager or someone that works with you or whatever, I think the first thing you have to do is go back and really analyze that and see, why was that trust broken? And was trust really broken? And maybe from the frame of reference of the other person, it wasn't, but from your frame of reference, it was. And I think that's the critical piece. And the reason I say that is because that kind of goes back to my, if you look to my info, I was telling you about my whole leadership model is called human factors leadership. And the reason I call it that is because, yes, I use examples from my previous life of flying high performance machines in very dynamic, challenging environments, how we led and our teams and executed. But it also talks about the science behind it, the kind of the human factors behind it, kind of the why we make decisions, going to that tribal mentality of our mind and how people work together and things like that. So the reason I say that is in a professional setting in today's world, and I'm sure most of the businesses and companies you work with, rarely, if ever, does anyone show up to work and say, I'm going to do a bad job today. You know, I'm going to make a mistake. I'm going to drop the ball. You know,
That's not the goal.
Consciously, right? Does anybody ever say that? And so that's why I say it's so important for us to go back and look why that trust was broken. Because when I talk about fixing things like that, whether it's trust or fixing what I call human error within the organization, right? Because as long as you have humans involved in anything, which is really everything, there's going to be human error. And that's going to result in the situations like you're talking about. I always say, go back and look at the system. Look at the systems-based approach. In aviation, we had to do this until the 70s or 80s, whenever an aircraft accident would happen, commercial, military, whatever, we'd say, oh, that's tragic. Flying is an inherently dangerous business. Pilot made a mistake. Hey, make sure you don't do this again, pilots. This is bad. And we'd go about our day. And nothing really happened to the accident rate. Matter of fact, it kept climbing. And then we had a few very high-profile accidents in the 70s and 80s with these large jumbo airliners that were just coming online. And we realized as an industry, we can't keep doing this. We've tried to correct pilots. We told them what happened. And then we finally realized, hey, these pilots aren't showing up saying, I'm going to have a bad flight today. I'm going to make a human error today and make a bad decision. It was the system, right? So the system and how we trained, the system and how we ran our crews, the system and our procedures, the system and how we communicated. And so we came up with how we can change the system versus, again, going back to that blame and train approach, which we know just doesn't work. Because yes, sometimes people do need to get trained. Yes, sometimes people need to learn a skill and a better and things like that. But typically, you know, it's something in the system that caused you to break that trust with that person. And again, I think that goes back to understanding, was the trust really broken, or is that just a perception issue on your part or their part? But then it goes back to ensuring we have fixed those gaps in the system, whatever that may be, which, you know, is a whole nother area.
Yeah, I interviewed a NASA executive a couple of years ago, Michael Cianelli, who was fantastic, talking about when failures happen at NASA. He's in charge of lessons learned, and they go back and debrief on everything. I'm assuming that the process is somewhat similar in your field.
Something near and dear to my heart, because coming from one of the biggest things I bring from what I did in my past is that idea, what you're talking about, which is what we call the debrief. And it's not just a debrief in that we talk about what went right, what went wrong, and how we're going to do it, but it's a inherently way in which we do it. And when I say that, because it's probably just very similar to NASA, but in the military, obviously everybody knows there's very clear rank structure, right? You know, we wear a rank on our shoulders and our hats and salute and yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, and yes, sir, no, sir, and all that, right? But when you are in an organization such as NASA or flying complex, high-performance machines in a very challenging environment where literally bad things can happen if you make mistakes, human error, you have to have an environment where you could talk about those mistakes and errors and successes so that we can make the team better and develop those lessons learned. And that's from the debrief. And probably very similar to the approach you're talking about, I call it a debrief culture, because it's the idea we're not just going to debrief once or twice a year, a handful of times after a major project. It's something we need to do kind of all the time. And a debrief doesn't have to be we go in a room for hours on end and talk about this whole thing. You will do that, but it can be as simple as I talk about this to my sales teams all the time. Hey, after a sales call, just go sit down and have a cup of coffee. Let's talk for maybe 10, 15 minutes. Talk about what went right, what went wrong, what we learned from that, what we're going to do next time. Just a quick rehash.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a formal, structured meeting even.
It doesn't. Now, for large projects or tasks, you probably should. And, you know, I have a structure for that I teach my clients on how to do that. But the key to that debrief, the difference that I bring, or that this idea of a debrief that we talk about, it's not just the idea you're talking about what went right, what went wrong. I mean, anybody can really do that, but it's that tone you set and how you set that environment. Because, you know, Gail, that is it natural for us to go in a room, me and you, if we're working together, and let's talk about what I went did wrong and what you did wrong. And it's not natural for us to admit our mistakes. It's not natural for us to own those mistakes. And so you have to have an environment where you can go in that room, shut the door or whatever you call it, or sit down. And that leader of that team might not be the most highest ranking person in an organization. They just may be the leader for that project or that task. But you have to have that idea, that debrief culture, that trust culture, or just culture, as I call it, where we sit down and the leader can first of all admit some of their shortcomings in the task. And when you do that, what does that do? That kind of takes down those barriers to everyone else saying, hey, look, if Brandon, who led this project, he can sit here and say he made some missteps, and I surely can. And I'll give you a quick example if you want, kind of relating it back to my world. So that airplane right there, that's a T-38. And so that's what we use as that's the jet trainer for the Air Force. So, you know, pilot training students in the Air Force, they go through what's called a T-6, which is a turboprop. And then pilots selected to go fly fighter aircraft and bombers, like I flew the F-15, they'll go train in this T-38, kind of their first step in that evolution of becoming a fighter pilot. And so you can imagine we have students in there, student pilots, men and women who have hardly ever flown anything before except what they flew in the Air Force. So maybe 100 hours. And now we're throwing in a machine that can go faster than the speed of sound right away. So you can imagine you coming back from the first few sorties and they're just sitting there thinking, oh man, that was just a horrible sortie. You know, I just made so many mistakes. Looking at me when I was an instructor, this fighter pilot instructor who has thousands of hours, you know, he's just going to rip me apart in this debrief, you know, tell me everything I did wrong. But what was the first thing, no matter what student I flew with, the first thing I always did, Gil, was I sat him down. I said, hey, before we start, say you were my student, Gil. I said, Gil, I noticed today your landings were a little long today. Gil, I think I could have helped you out there in the brief if I could have taught you a better power pull technique on how to pull your power. And I think if I had taught you that or told you that, your landing spot would have been better. So I'll take that back on me. So what am I doing now? I'm saying, hey, yeah, I'm owning that your mistakes were essentially root cause was my fault because I failed to give you the technique. But if leaders can adopt that, even if it's little small things you can admit you did wrong, especially the people that maybe aren't as higher as you in that organization can say, well, if they can admit that, then surely I can open up some mistake.
Well, if I were your student, I would just be asking you how I don't throw up because I get motion sickness. So not a likely scenario, but I get your point.
But if you don't have that tone and that psychological safe, you know, for lack of a better term, tone in that debrief, you're never going to get the results you're going to want. You're going to have that, what we call artificial harmony, which just doesn't make the team better, unfortunately.
Yeah, tone is so important. And I do emphasize that a lot with my clients too. And it's so hard for people who keep saying, well, I've told people what they need to do. And I said, it's not what you're telling. It's not the words. It's the tone that needs to shift. So I'm glad to hear you echoing that. I wanted to shift gears because we've talked about lessons learned and owning failure or, you know, being ultimately accountable for results. But you're a fighter pilot. So you know that there will be turbulence when you're flying. And I'm sure in your training, there's some specific things that you do to prepare for turbulence. And so I want to know, is there a certain mindset that trains you to do? I mean, aside from, okay, push, you know, do this gear, whatever, like all the mechanical stuff that you have to know, it seems like there needs to be a mindset when you go into it. And I think there are probably lessons that leaders can learn from that. I love working with leaders to help them prep for that and anticipate it. So what would some parallels be there?
Yeah, I mean, that there's so many different ways I could go with that question. I love that question.
I know it's a big topic, but I just have to talk about it. It's so important for leaders to know that that's the norm. It's not the exception, that the future is turbulent and that's just to be accepted.
Yeah, I'll set it with two things first. I say this in my talks a lot. I say, look, you know, my day job now flying as a captain for a major commercial airline, you know, a little different than flying fighter aircraft, but I'm still flying. And I say, look, you know, flying straight and level, 30,000 feet on autopilot, no weather, not a lot going on, right? You know, I mean, there's not a very high intense environment at that moment. However, what if I do lose an engine right now? What if we do get a fire? What if we do get smoke? What if the flight attendant calls me and say, there is a medical emergency in the back and we got to get on the ground sooner, this person's going to bad things are going to happen. I mean, it goes from 0 to 100 like that, right? And that's not the time to start scrambling and saying, okay, where are we at? Where do I need to go? Where's the closest airport that may have a, you know, a runway? What are the initial items if we have a fire we're going to do, which we train to this? You know, what are the initial action items we're going to do to keep that fire suppressed and how we're going to go? So my point is, I'm constantly kind of in the back of my mind as we're cruising along, always thinking, hey, if I need to divert somewhere, where's the nearest airport? Where's the best airport to go to? If we lose pressurization right now, where are we going to, because we got to get down right now so everybody has oxygen to breathe. Where are we going to go to? You've got to be ready for that. So you're kind of not just spending 100% of the time on it, but it's what I call this healthy paranoia. It's kind of this little thing in the back of your mind, kind of just what if, you know, you're not spending all your time on it, but maybe 10-20% on it. So that's the first thing.
I like the emphasis on healthy.
Healthy paranoia. Yeah, it's not paranoia. It's just a little bit of, you know, what could go wrong, right? Just kind of the back of your mind. And because like with leadership, anybody can lead when everything is going according to plan, right? Leaders make their money and make their mark. What? When something goes wrong or something goes out of the ordinary. You talked about earlier being flexible. Leadership is flexibility. And so to go back to answer your question again, the second part, you said, how did you train? What was your mindset to develop that? One of the things that come to mind is something you learn this actually in day one of Air Force pilot training. And it was this three-step approach. And they say, you're going to use this approach no matter what happens. If something out of the ordinary happens, you have an emergency procedure. These are the first three things you're going to think about. Number one is maintain aircraft control. Number two is analyze the situation and take the proper action. And number three is land as soon as conditions permit. I learned that in 2001, you know, and rote memorization, and it's still just there. And so that's important though, because number one, maintain aircraft control. What does that mean? Well, if you have something going on in your aircraft, especially modern aircraft, chances are the airplane's not just going to, the wing's not going to fall off and, you know, that it's not just going to simultaneously explode, right? You probably have time to think about things. But again, going back to human factors, and this happens in leadership, what do we do when fires pop up? What do we do when things start going wrong in our teams? We start to kind of get tunnel vision a little bit, start to get stressed out, and we can make irrational decisions. And so the first thing is remember your priorities, maintain aircraft control, keep the plane level, because it does no good if you're handling this situation, this bad emergency, and you lose control of the airplane, right? Just like in your business, it does no good if you lose sight of the main point of your business and you're trying to deal with all these other fires that maybe, you know, you got to attend to them, but it might not be the most important thing. So that's the first thing, maintain aircraft control.
But to do that, wouldn't you have to maintain control of yourself? Like self-regulate first. That's the hardest part for so many executives that I see, is how do I calm myself down?
I'm so glad you asked that, because when people ask that, when I say maintain aircraft control, something we used to always say is the first thing you do, any kind of situation, when you're doing that, you hack the clock. So in every airplane I flew, there was always a little, now they're all digital, but back then, you know, in the T-38, they still had a little, analog clock or whatever. And you would literally push a button to hack it. It'd go to zero and then start ticking down. Now, why did we do that? Well, number one, there are some procedures that you may need to know how much time you have. Like if you were having an impending battery failure and you knew you had about 10 or 15 minutes to land before you had a complete electrical failure or this. But the real main reason we did that, because when you hack the clock, and I told this to business leaders too, for the exact reason you're talking about, when you hack the clock, you're kind of tricking your mind to kind of make some time for yourself, right? And so for business leaders, I always say hack the clock. What does that mean? Do you literally have to hack a clock? No, but it means to sit down, take a breath, and just kind of recage, right? Just kind of slow things down a little bit yourself, especially in business. I mean, you're leading a sales team and something's going wrong. I mean, people probably are not going to die because of, you know, you're in action right away, but it's not going to hurt you to sit down. Okay, let's reassess, see what we got. What's the situation? Analyze the situation, which is the next step. Take the proper action. So make a decision, move forward, and then land as soon as conditions permit. So a lot of times I say, you know, when something's going wrong as a business leader, when I say analyze the situation, take the proper action, that doesn't mean you're coming up with a whole plan B. It just means you're kind of stopping the bleeding, or you're just kind of putting the fire out for now. Now you got to land as soon as conditions permit. So I've solved this problem in my aircraft, but I've still got to land this crippled airplane, right? Or I've still got to get this team back on track. So we've kind of, client called us with a major issue. We've got to deal with this right away, right? Okay, so let's put someone on that. Let's get them what we're going to do to fix this immediate right now. Okay, now we got that solved. Now we can go back to getting everything back in order. So it's really an exercise in prioritization and really keeping your focus on what's most important. And to your point, Gail, that's why you have that mantra to kind of keep you in an orderly state so you don't just start losing your mind when something goes wrong.
Yeah. Well, you just touched on something I wanted to pick up on too, is the importance of letting your team know we've got this. Here's what we're doing next. Here's the next step. So just having that confidence in them to pull through, I think will help you too.
Yeah. Having the confidence in your team, because that goes back to, I talk about decentralized execution as a main component of my model, which really is leadership-backed autonomy, right? It's really that people have this misconception a lot of times in the military that just kind of wake up, march, do what we're told, and kind of, you know, follow orders, especially in the world I came from, combat aviation, or think about special operations teams or many other parts of the military, elite performing teams. It really, nothing could be farther from the truth. I mean, flying the F-15, you know, I remember as a young, 25, 26 years old, you know, I'm out hundreds and hundreds of miles with my wingman, with a team, my wingman in the other aircraft, and a backseater. I flew with a weapon systems officer, but we were separated hundreds and hundreds of miles from any type of leadership authority in a combat situation. And we had to make decisions that were literally, if we made the wrong decision, I mean, that could mean strategic implications for our country, you know, and so many other things. And so, but we were put with that trust and that autonomy, which again, Gail, goes back to, guess what, tying it back into peer accountability, mutual support, because that's how we built our teams. That's how we trained. The whole basis was mutual support, always going out with a team. And you're talking about trusting your people. You're trusting your people because you have that peer accountability built within your organization to solve those problems.
Yeah, that's so good. I think we've come almost full circle. So, and I know we're getting toward the end of our time, but I just did want to ask if you have some specific advice for leaders who really do want to become better at dealing with change, maybe even inspiring change, moving through change and helping their teams do that, because it is not easy. And just when they think they've figured something out, something else is in front of them. So what advice would you have for people that really want to get better?
I'm going to leave you two things, if you don't mind. The first, because I think it's so perfect, you know, we kind of touched on one. The first is what I call a narrow focus, right? So people talk about, you know, strategy and vision and all this stuff, and that's great. But when you take that strategy and vision and you really want to connect it, you have something we had in the military, we called it commander's intent. And it wasn't, yes, it was strategy, but it was really how you connected strategy execution. So in other words, it was that very clear and focused end state. What does that end state actually look like? You know, where we're going, what does it look like? But not only that, it was very focused. So, and why I say that for your people listening is that this happens to business leaders all the time. I ask them, well, what's your strategic initiatives for this quarter or this year? And what do they inevitably do? Rattle off like, you know, 10 or 15 things. And I'm like, okay, that's great. I agree. You want to do all that stuff. But what is your most important three, and I'll just say three initiatives. What is the most important? We got to do all that. Everything's important. Well, yeah, no, but you've got to have three priorities. And what I'm trying to drive at to them is, look, flying that F-15, there were 250 switches, dials, and displays in that airplane, right? The human mind, there's no possible way I'm taking in all that data at once, right? But my mentors, my instructors, my flight leadership over the years had taught me, when I'm in certain situations, these are the two or three most important instruments, Brandon, you need to focus on. This is what's going to keep you safe. This is where you look for this data. That experience, right? You start to know where to look for those things. Because the human mind, you probably heard this, but the idea of multitasking is a myth, right? We can only truly task switch. And so that's the first thing, is that very clear, narrow focus to lead through complexity and uncertainty. Make it simple as possible.
And I just want to add to that, to this, before you get to the second point, is knowing that even that will change. Like, you can have your top three priorities and maybe 6 months later, there is a shift. And it's okay to let go or change out one, but just to be sure that you are clear so that then you're guiding your team to not feel like you have to be locked in if it doesn't make sense, or if the environment has changed and you need to develop something new. So I just wanted to add that too.
Flexibility is the key to air power, and flexibility is the key to leadership, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. So what was your second point then?
Sorry. And the second one kind of goes to what you just said, actually, and we touched on it, but the debrief. So having this culture of debriefing, and that goes back to what you just said, because we're going to have to adjust. And that's going to come out if you're have this culture of debriefing. So where we start, because if you just do a debrief, let's say two or three times a year, what's going to happen? It's probably not going to go well, because it's not something that, again, like I said earlier, it's not something that our human mind naturally wants to do. But if you can make it a culture of how we do things regularly and know how to do that and practice that like anything else, that's how you know where your adjustments are. That's how you know where your lessons learned are. That's how you know how you're going to adjust those priorities and how you're, what you need to provide for your team. As I said earlier, where are those gaps in the system? Because people don't just show up saying, I'm going to make a mistake. It's a gap in the system, whether it's a lack of communication, lack of knowledge, lack of oversight, you know, complacency, mental, physical fatigue, you name it. I mean, it's always some human factor that is affecting that person's decision. So those debriefs, that culture debrief is the only way to really, truly get that out effectively.
Yeah. To normalize that and know that, oh, we're not having a debrief because something went wrong and we have to get to the bottom of something.
That is a great point. That is a phenomenal point, because another thing when people hear about the debrief, they think, oh, well, we're just going to do this when something goes wrong. It's kind of like when people, I hate the term postmortem because it's just a bad term, right? It's not, because when somebody hits a home run, you know, you want the entire team to hit a home run. I mean, the thousands and thousands of hours I flew in the F-15E, I mean, I probably had close to 1,000 debriefs, you know, just estimating. What percentage of those do you think the mission went, we hit our objectives and the mission went well? I mean, what do you think?
50% maybe?
90% or more. I mean, you know, as far as hitting our objectives, but here's my point with that. We learn something every single time after that mission, because a lot of times what you learn when you debrief successes, you learn about near misses. Hey, this almost went off the rails right here. You may not have thought about, you may not have discovered that or talked about it, you know, if you hadn't have sat down and really debriefed it. So, but you always learn something, even successes.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of the emphasis in my work, is really getting to the root cause of success and building on what works. So yeah, got to look at both sides for sure. Good. Well, I'm so glad we could take this little flight on my podcast today. And before we land this jet, I want to know the best way that people can reach you and find out more.
Absolutely. Well, I'm on LinkedIn is probably my biggest social media that I'm on. Connect me on LinkedIn. I'm also on Instagram, Facebook. And then my website is actually www.lead-tac.com.
Got it. Yeah, we'll include all that in the show notes. So no worries there. All right. Well, thanks again, Brandon, for joining me. It's been really insightful. And I know that our listeners will be able to put a lot of what you've talked about into practice. And that's what's most important. So thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Gail, so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And for everyone else listening in, I hope you have a great rest of the week working through any turbulence that you experience while doing the work that matters to you. Thanks for tuning in. And as always, be sure to share this episode with someone else who might benefit, or leave a review. You can join my email list by going to workmatters.com so you don't miss an episode. And there you can learn more about ways we serve mission-driven leaders like you. If there's a challenge you want to discuss, I'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, keep growing as a leader, inspiring change, and doing the work that matters to you.